if you don't have a proper gut microbiome at baseline, you're not going to poop if you're a carnivore, and you're not going to poop if you're an omnivore. After seeing, like, you know, about 50% of my practice of people coming in with, like, hey doc, I have hemorrhoids, hey doc, I have bleeding in the butt, I have pain in the butt, like, what's going on? I realized that I was telling patients like 20, 30 times a day that this is, you know, possibly because of your bowel movements.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, words cannot describe how satisfying and how much I enjoyed this conversation today with Dr. Carmen Fong. If you at all have ever even remotely struggled with your bowel movements, and yes, 30% of you do have constipation, you have got to check out her book, Constipation Nation, ASAP. And even if you don't struggle with constipation, I'm so jealous, you will learn so much in today's episode. We talk all about how your colon works and how to keep things moving and flowing in the most healthy way possible. You'll learn the one poop commandment that you need to be doing, the difference between genders when it comes to toilet habits, how you should be using the toilet, the role of laxatives and what they do, how much of them you can take and can you be on them long term, the role of fiber in our diet, and can you go on a low or even no fiber diet, the vast importance of the gut microbiome, what you need to know about hemorrhoids, the role of constipation in kids and potty training, and a lot of very personal stories about my own personal bowel movement history. I had the time of my life talking with Dr. Fong. I plan to go see her as a practitioner as well because yes, she is in Atlanta. I actually had no idea about that until I sat down to do the interview, which is kind of cool. And I cannot recommend you check out all of her work enough. You can find her work at carmenfong.com. And if you would like to work with her either in person or via telehealth, go to bummed.co and use code BACKEDBYCARMEN to get 15% off your first order. Signing up for her email list will also get you a constipation prevention guide. And you can also get a guide, if you like, to avoiding constipation with GLP-1 receptor agonists. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/constipation. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Dr. Carmen Fong. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. So the backstory on today's conversation, as you guys know, I talk a lot about bowel movements and diet and that whole world, that whole topic. And again, as a lot of you guys know, because I know I've been talking about it for years, especially on the Intermittent Fasting podcast, I personally, for the majority of my life, for a long part of my life, I didn't think about bowel movements at all. I didn't think about if I was constipated. I just didn't think about it. And then I had what I call the inciting incident of food poisoning, as well as some other health-related things that happened around the same time. And I developed chronic constipation of sorts. And in this episode, we'll talk about the different types of constipations. But when that happened, I developed, honestly, a sort of, I would say, like a psychological complex fear surrounding the motility of my intestines. And I remember thinking, like, wow, it's crazy to think that there was a time when I wasn't thinking all the time about my bowel movements. And now here I am in therapy, like talking about it for hours. And so with that, I became a little bit obsessive with food and diet and supplements and lifestyle and what makes things move through us in a good way that we like and what makes things get stuck. So to say I'm a little bit obsessed with this topic for like a decade, I'm not kidding. So point being is I was super excited when I was introduced to today's fabulous guest who, side note, we just realized we both live in Atlanta, so we've probably crossed paths before.
So weird. Yeah.
I know. But I'm here with Dr. Carmen Fong. She is a Chinese American writer and colorectal surgeon. And yes, we will talk about the differences between colorectal surgeons and like your typical GI doc, which I didn't even realized there was a difference. So we will talk about that. She's from New York City, and she, for the past 3 years, has now been in Atlanta with her wife, her three kids. Well, she has a new infant, which is so, so exciting. And there are two cats. She's the co-director of the Hemorrhoid Centers of America and specializes in office-based proctology. She most recently was an assistant professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She sees patients with constipation all the time. And I had her on for her book, or I'm having her on for her book, called, wait for it, Constipation Nation, What to Know When You Can't Go. And friends, what was so incredibly fabulous and wonderful about this book is, like I said, I am not kidding in that I've been obsessed with this topic for a decade. And the majority of the books that I read on the subject or articles or resources typically are surface level overview of what constipation is and then like the diet to do for it. This book is everything I could have ever wanted to know about the anatomy of our entire digestive system, what actually happens, what, you know, goes wrong with things like constipation, what we can do to address it. And then on top of that, it's not, she doesn't just talk about constipation. She talks about all the other different colorectal type diseases that you can get in your body. So I have so many questions. I actually have a ton of questions from you guys as well, because when I floated this by you all, people were very, they had a lot of questions. So lots of notes, lots of questions. Dr. Fong, thank you so much for all that you do. And thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you so much for having me and for that, like, you know, resounding announcement for my book. Cause I just, you know, sometimes I forget how much stuff is in there until somebody like tells me about it.
You know? No, to that point, there's so much in there. And I was going to ask you, because there's so many different things that you could write about. And you even say, like, there's just one part of the book that I really like. And it's, I mean, I like the whole book, but there's this one part where you talk about common complaints you get from patients. And it's like, doctor, I'm experiencing this, or doctor, I'm experiencing that. And then you have the potential diagnosis that you could give. But all, I think all of those that you list there, like none of them are actually constipation that you hypothesize. So I'm really curious, out of all the things, why constipation is, you know, what you really wanted to focus on with this. And I know you say that you historically have not had the chronic constipation experience, except for like, you know, some pregnancy stuff. So why this book?
No, that's a fantastic question. So first of all, it has a cute title because it rhymes. No, but honestly, I was, you know, practicing as like a young attending in New York City. And the first few years after I started practicing, I started seeing, you know, as a general colorectal surgeon, you see basically all the bread and butter of colorectal surgery, which is like, you know, colon cancer, rectal cancer, diverticulitis. But you also do a lot of anal rectal disease, which is where the proctology comes in, which is like truly the study of anal rectal disease. And after seeing like, you know, about 50% of my practice of people coming in with like, hey doc, I have hemorrhoids. Hey doc, I have bleeding in the butt. I have pain in the butt. Like what's going on? I realized that I was telling patients like 20, 30 times a day that this is, you know, possibly because of your bowel movements. And I just remember people being like, things that happen in my butt have something to do with what I eat, which, and it was like, you know, kind of like a light bulb moment for them. And after that, one of my medical assistants actually was like, hey, you know, why don't you make this into a book? Because I had started making a little handout where I would be like, hey, you know, this is a constipation prevention guide. Preventing constipation will help you prevent all these like hemorrhoids, anal fissures, anal fistulas, like all these things that you're experiencing. And it had just basically like drink more water, eat more fiber. And, you know, these are the things that have fiber sources in them. But then once she started saying, hey, you know, why don't you like expand this into a book? Because like I'm like going into the explanation so much, again, 20, 30 times a day, I started researching it. And one of the things I found was how much we don't know. like even as medical professionals, like it's humbling to think that there's stuff we don't know. But in medical school, we learn about, you know, constipation, we learn about, and in surgery residency, we learn about surgery and how to like cut things out. But we really have no idea, like, you know, the functional nutrition and the physiology and like exercise physiology and all of these other things that go into it. Like constipation is actually like a super complex topic. There's like pelvic floor dysfunction that goes into it. And I know you said that your readers like a deep dive. And I really did a deep dive into constipation. And the more I read about it, the more, you know, fascinated I was by the topic.
Oh my goodness. I love this so much. And you know what was really interesting? I'm having so many flashbacks right now because, like I said, I really did develop like a psychological complex around my bowel movements. And I was interviewing different therapists, trying to find a therapist. This was when I was in LA, and I kind of had some horror stories of like interviewing therapists. But I remember one of them. So one of them, I like told my whole story about my anxieties, about my bowel movements and how I felt toxic, which by the way, I identified with this historical idea of auto-intoxication. I was like, I feel it. But we can circle back to that. But I remember like one of the therapists was like, well, maybe you should just drink more water. And I was like, okay, this is not the place. Like, this is not the answer. Like, another one actually said, I'm trying to decide if I should actually say what she said. It's an expletive. It was kind of a funny joke, but it was not the timing. Because I like, again, I told her all my fears about feeling toxic. And she was like, well, maybe some, I'll just say it. I apologize, listeners. She was like, well, maybe some people are just full of shit. And I was like, oh, okay, also not the therapist for me. But my question here is, it was interesting reading your book because, like you said, there are so many factors and different things that people do. And yet a huge takeaway still seemed to be like more fiber and water. Like with all of the research that you've done, is there something that tends to work for most people or is it really nuanced? Like just what is the broad spectrum of what works for people?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I have people who have read the book and I have patients of mine who have read the book and they bring it in and they're like, you say here, do this and this and this. And I do think that most of the time, it still is a little process of trial and error because all bodies are different. On the other hand, I've kind of boiled it down to like a standard five things that you should kind of throw at it before you are like, hey, you know, this isn't working. This is no longer functional constipation, and we need to go down the diagnostic pathway. So the five things are fiber, right? 25 to 35 grams of fiber a day, both soluble and insoluble fiber. Water, 2 to 3 liters a day. And generally, I always love to tell people that fiber without water turns into concrete in your colon. So if you're eating a ton of, you know, psyllium husk and, you know, kale and whatever, but you're like not drinking water, it'll still just sit in your colon and it can become like a stool ball. Number three is magnesium. So magnesium supplementation helps with the colon motility. Number four is probiotics. So having the proper gut microbiome and avoiding gut dysbiosis is going to help with the consistency and the frequency of your stools. And then number five is obviously having like a moderately active lifestyle. So being too sedentary isn't good for your gut because your gut needs that activity to move. I also point out that actually being too active causes a sympathetic response in your body and you actually can have, you know, go into a fight or flight response and your body's like, we're no longer going to rest and digest. We're actually just going to, you know, pump our blood to our heart and our legs so that we can run away if there's a lion, right? So you're not actually going to digest so well. I just wanted to point out that, like, you know, your story is actually super classic. Like for someone who listens to this type of thing like 3,000 times a year, having that inciting incident is actually kind of common. So having like some kind of like a GI bug or like, you know, if you had COVID for a couple of weeks or if you, some people will say they were like hospitalized with pneumonia for a couple of weeks, something about that messes with your gut microbiome. And we know that now. And it takes a long time to recover, sometimes 10 years, but sometimes because people aren't even realizing that that's the problem, like we're not taking the steps to change it. So I think that's probably what happened is the gut microbiome. And then over time, a lot of it did become not psychological because, like, you know, I don't think any of this is like, you know, psychological, but we know now that the gut microbiome, right, influences the gut-brain interactions. And so, you know, 90% of our serotonin is produced in the bowels. And so some of that is going to be responsible for how your body reacts to your bowel movements as well. And it's like crazy to think about, but I always think it's like super fascinating.
I'm just loving this conversation. I have so many things I want to talk to you about. It's interesting because, so I've actually had, and because I'm in my mid-30s, and I've had 3 colonoscopies by this point, including one when I was like admitted in the hospital for anemia, and they were like, we want to do a colonoscopy. So then I had to do the bowel prep like while being in the bed, you know? So I had to like call the nurse every time I wanted to. It was literally the worst experience. It's interesting because you said back to back, you listed the 5 things, and one was magnesium, one was probiotics. Interestingly, I said I got a lot of listener questions. One listener actually said, it was Karen. She said, taking magnesium and a probiotic has pretty much solved my constipation issues. Her question was, she wanted to know different causes and how to address it, which we'll dive into. But interestingly, another listener also, her name was Maris. She said, I suffer from it. Taking seed, which is a probiotic that I like, taking seed and magnesium help. So that's another person who said that combination. And then she wanted to know actually, because I have a question about the magnesium. She said, how much magnesium is too much? At what point does it become dangerous for the kidneys? I currently take 500 milligrams of Melanie's magnesium 8 and then 500 milligrams of threonate. Can my body handle more than that? Because I feel that I have adapted to this dosage. And then she has a really fascinating second question. But on the magnesium front, I'm really intrigued by this because I do have my own magnesium supplements. I take a lot of magnesium because it really, really helps me. But then I get kind of worried, and I was thinking about this with what you said a second ago about how people can have this incident that can take years to resolve, but then it does kind of become, I know you say you don't really like the word psychological, but that becomes an aspect of it. And so I almost wonder, for me, like with the magnesium, like have kind of similar to Maris, like it helps me so much and it keeps things flowing, but I wonder how much of me is like locking myself into that by doing that so much. And then I know one of the doctors that performed one of my colonoscopies was like, well, just take Miralax. And I was like, well, I take magnesium and that helps. And she was like, no, well, you should take Miralax instead because that's more studied than magnesium. So I just threw so much at you, but magnesium.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So different forms of magnesium. I'll start from the top. So the main question is if you can have too much magnesium, and the answer is yes. So generally we try not to do over 1 gram of magnesium a day. For example, if you're in the hospital and you need a magnesium repletion, like your magnesium levels are low, we do 1 gram of magnesium sulfate, right, a day. And so, but that's magnesium sulfate. And then magnesium, as you know, comes in like a ton of different forms, some of which are better and some of which are more effective for different things. So magnesium glycinate, you know, we know that, you know, works better for a little better for sleep, a little better for relaxation, but also works really well in relaxing the colon smooth muscle. And that's how it works with, you know, colon motility and constipation. Magnesium oxide is actually the only one that has been super proven, as in like there's been the most studies done for constipation. And so magnesium oxide generally is about 400 to 800 milligrams a day. Again, not going over that, you know, 1 gram limit. And it sounds like your listener wasn't going over the 1 gram limit either. And then you have like things like magnesium citrate, which comes in like natural calm gummies. And so magnesium citrate is great because it does work for both the bowels and for relaxation and sleep. But magnesium citrate in high doses can actually give you like explosive diarrhea and the runs. So you really wouldn't want like magnesium citrate at high doses, like on an everyday basis. The safer ones are like threonate, glycinate, and oxide. And then last but not least, like an age-old remedy is milk of magnesia or magnesium hydroxide, that like chalky stuff that our grandmother...
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that our grandmothers used to drink. And that stuff is actually also super potent. So that usually is like, you know, 2 to 4 teaspoons a day. You also wouldn't want to be on that one chronically either. I think the second part of the question is, so you can't have too much magnesium. It sounds like the doses that you guys have are reasonable. Can you get addicted to it? Generally, our science right now is that you cannot get addicted to it. Magnesium is like a naturally occurring, you know, mineral. You get it in fruits and vegetables. So it's not something you can get addicted to. The third part of the question, though, is the Miralax. And You know, in the old days, we actually used to think that Miralax did have some addictive potential, but now we know that there isn't. There is actually no addictive potential to Miralax. Miralax is an osmotic laxative, and it generally is the first line that people will throw at, you know, anybody with constipation type symptoms. And I do that as well, but I find that it's usually not the most effective just because it has to be taken a certain way. So because Miralax is polyethylene glycol, so it's an osmotic laxative, when you take it over the counter type, it's like 17 grams versus if you do like a colonoscopy prep, like you were describing, you do 4 liters of it, right? But the 17 grams, it's, again, you need to take it with a glass of water. And then I usually have people chug some water after it, because if you don't do that, you can get dehydrated and the stools can actually still get like firmer and not softer, because the way it works is by drawing water into the stool. So I'll have people be like, hey, I stirred this into my coffee every day. Like, why isn't it working? Well, you know, there's still like that little bit of the caffeine element that can still dehydrate you, and you still need to drink water with it. So it's not my first line for throwing at things.
Okay, friends, I am so honored that today's episode is brought to you in part by Activation Products. I'm a little bit obsessed with Activation. I've actually had the founder, Ian Clark, on the show, and he completely blew my mind about one of the best ways to support your immune system. I love so many of their products, and one that I completely keep on hand and use all the time is called Perfect Immune. As you guys know, I personally try to avoid taking antibiotics whenever I can, just to protect my gut health, and so for me, this has truly been a lifesaver. Perfect Immune is made from an extract of Pelargonium sedoides, which is a plant native to South Africa that has been used for centuries to kill all kinds of respiratory infections. We are talking things like bronchitis, common colds, sinus infections, and even the flu virus. And there's a reason they've been using it for years and years and years, because it actually works. I take it regularly, and especially when I feel a cold or sinus infection coming on. And what I really love about it is just how simple it is. I take about 10 drops as part of my routine, especially during travel or stressful seasons. If I start feeling that little scratch in my throat or a cough, I start taking it like twice or even 3 times a day, and it really helps it go away almost every single time. And especially if you're someone who has any kind of autoimmune disorder or gets sick a lot, this is just a really great way to feel supported and prepared. You can check it out at activationproducts.com and use the code Avalon for a discount. That's activationproducts.com with the code Avalon. This is how much I love it. When I decided to partner with Activation, they were like, what products do you want to feature? And I was like, Perfect Immune. It is a game changer for me. Friends, get it now. activationproducts.com with the coupon code Avalon.
Okay, so some follow-up questions. So that, and I know you're obviously not in this person's head, but if you were to hypothesize, did that doctor tell me the Miralax thing because that benefits the pharmaceutical, like that's like money-driven answer?
You know, Miralax does do like a lot of promotion and like samples these days, but honestly, they are not super rep driven. So I don't know that like the doctor makes money from it. What I think is the more likely answer is that that's what we're taught in medical school, is to say Miralax. I actually had to do quite a bit of digging to find even the magnesium answer, which is like crazy to me, right? But that's not something we're taught in medical school, is to, you know, have like 5 different options for constipation. It's just Miralax. And if not, I don't know. You know?
Okay. That makes sense. Cause I remember I was like, magnesium works for me. And she was like, well, that's not studied. So you should do Miralax.
It is actually very like, it's actually a lot of studies in it. But again, that's why I like the multidisciplinary nature of the book, because a lot of the studies are more in like physiology and like nutritional and dietary research and not necessarily in our medical journals.
Okay. Yeah. And then you mentioned the osmotic laxative. And by the way, when I asked for questions, I got so many questions about laxatives. So like Lori wanted to know how often you should take laxatives. It's not good to take them regularly, but how often actually is okay. And in the book, you talk about 5 different types, one of which you just mentioned now, the osmotic one. So is the magnesium oxide an osmotic laxative, or all the Like, how would you classify the different magnesiums as far as like type of laxative?
So technically magnesium oxide or magnesium is an osmotic laxative. So Miralax is an osmotic laxative, but that draws water into your stool. Magnesium, I kind of consider a supplement, but it is also considered a laxative, like an osmotic laxative, especially when it's hydroxide. The other types that people usually ask about are things like stimulant laxatives. And so that's like Senna and Dulcolax. And those ones are the ones that you can like get addicted to and have some addictive potential where you can develop lazy colon over time. There recently was another study though that Senecot, which is like kind of the most natural form of the stimulant laxatives, actually does not have long-term addictive potential. So I've actually been able to be like, hey, you know, you can take Senecot, you know, more often than you think. I still reserve it as like a, you know, sixth line option these days, just to throw in there that Dulcolax is the only one now that is a stimulant laxative that has like habit forming potential. So that's the one you don't want to be using like every single day, because eventually your body will be like, hey, we require this to move, and then it won't move without it, right? So that's the idea. Apparently in like the late 50s and 60s, this was super common. People would just be like on laxatives all the time for weight loss and to poop every day. And so all these people have like, you know, lazy colons or colons that don't work great 50 or 60 years later.
Oh my goodness. Is it reversible?
Not really. So it can be overcome with things like magnesium and a good diet and Miralax, but it's not super reversible. When it's really bad, that's the case where we have to do a lot of like diagnostic steps and then do surgery.
Oh, wow. I know the one I experimented with quite a bit, because when I was in my constipation phase, which again, I still feel the trauma from it, but I tried everything. And so for a while I was doing the herb cascara. Yeah. So I don't know how to say the second part, sagras. I call it cascara. I'm not sure. Was that addictive? Do you know?
Cascara actually is a stimulant laxative, and there is a little bit of habit forming potential. Yeah. So the next book, when I get there, actually has a few things about these like natural supplements. So cascara is one of them. The other one that people often ask me about is slippery elm. Yeah. So slippery elm actually kind of works almost like as a stool softener and makes it a little more slippery. And that one is not addictive. And then the third most common one these days is flaxseed. So flaxseed works a lot like psyllium husk. And it's basically it's an irritant or an osmotic laxative. It draws water in, but also irritates the colon to help you poop.
Is that irritation bad for the colon? Because I know I've often read, and you mentioned in the book, how different types of fiber, some like insoluble fiber is like a mechanical, it has like a mechanical irritation, I think, to the colon. Is that correct? So is that bad for the colon?
No. So it's actually good. So it's what your colon needs to move in some ways. And so that's why this was one of the things that I learned in writing this, was that, you know, when we're in medical school and when you're a surgeon, people ask you about constipation and your automatic reflex is eat more fiber, drink more water, take some Miralax, right? Like exactly what you heard. But then people would start asking me like, but what types of fiber? You know, like what's the difference between the types of fiber and like how much water and like why does Miralax work? The soluble fiber turns into a gel in your colon. And so it kind of like binds all of cholesterols and the fats and stuff and actually and the toxins, right? And actually helps everything move through. And so that's why soluble fibers tend to be things like oats and psyllium husk. And they're known for their cardiovascular health properties. So, you know, because they bind all the cholesterol and move everything out. But that is also the one that, you know, you need to drink more water, otherwise it turns into like a goop in your colon and doesn't move out. The other one, the insoluble fibers, so things like the roughage, like literally kale and stringy parts of celery stalks and like spinach and stuff, apple peels. So that stuff is required, you know, to irritate the lining of your colon to propel everything through. Your colon also does have like a lot of contractility on its own, like in the form of MMCs, which kind of come through and sweep everything through every 90 minutes.
It's funny because in the whole carnivore world, they will often use that terminology, that phrase about how it's an irritant and say like, you know, does that sound like something good for your colon? Like, you know, and I think even I was really excited that you mentioned the Fibrominis guy. I actually talked with him because I read his book. I probably read his book when I was in my constipation phase. And for listeners, his name is Konstantin.
I think it's Umansky.
I think I've never said it out loud. I've just read it.
Yeah, I think I saw your podcast.
So I talked with him a while back, but he's a lot about the low I mean, it's been a while since I read it, like a low or no fiber diet, which is also similar in the carnivore world, where they talk about the benefit of that for bowel movements. And examples they'll give is like when you're a baby, you know, but although babies, I guess, get fiber from the breast milk maybe. But basically the idea is that fiber, that we can have bowel movements without fiber, and that may even be beneficial. And I know there's that one study that all the carnivore people reference, but it was a really small study. I think it was like 8 people maybe. It wasn't a lot of people, but basically it was people with, I think, idiopathic constipation, and they all completely 100% resolved when they went on a zero fiber diet. So yeah, what do you think is happening there, and what are your thoughts on that and the health of that for the colon?
No, I actually love that. I think you're the first person who's asked me that, and because I think about this a lot. And one of the things that Dr. Umansky references, and I think about it a lot, is that in some cultures, like some Asian cultures, Japan, for example, it's kind of like a lot of protein, right? So you're eating a lot of like raw fish, and you're actually not eating a ton of vegetables. I think in that scenario, there is something secondary going on there, which is they eat a lot of pickled vegetables. So the pickled vegetables act as a prebiotic, and there's obviously like the rice, which is like a whole grain and some fiber involved. But then the argument was that you have smaller, smoother poops, and they're just not these like huge, bulky poops. And so I think that is actually true in somewhat, but I think it only works in people with a proper gut microbiome. I know that's like weird to say, but if you don't have a proper gut microbiome at baseline, you're not going to poop if you're a carnivore, and you're not going to poop if you're an omnivore. I think for the most part, humans were meant to be omnivores and have like some parts of like fruits and vegetables in our diet, like as evidenced by our like teeth and our molars and stuff like that. So it's like, you don't need to have a ton of fiber. And I have definitely seen people go overboard with their fiber. And so that's why I'm always like, everything in moderation. You don't need to eat like a giant bowl of kale every day. You can just eat chicken nuggets and poop. Like kids, you're right, do just eat chicken nuggets and poop. But the other part of it is the fluids and their colon motility and their gut microbiome. There's just like, you know, so many different things that go into it that I don't think we can just be like, well, if you only eat meat, you poop better. Does that make sense?
It does completely. And honestly, because something you said just now, getting all the flashbacks, I wonder, something that happened to me, and I wonder if this happens to other people as well, is if you're in a state of constipation, and I guess we should probably also define the different types of constipation, like functional and secondary and primary and slow transit and normal transit. But regardless, if you're in a state of chronic constipation, and if it's due to like some other reason, I wonder how often, because I know this happened to me, I was like, well, I'll just eat. Because I think the main reason for me, I do think the inciting incident was the microbiome disruption, food poisoning. But then I was very hypothyroid, because when I went on thyroid meds, my bowel movements like came back and it was amazing. So when I was in that hypothyroid constipated state, I definitely went through a phase where I was like, eat all the fiber. And so one of the issues that I developed was I was like eating all this fiber, but nothing was coming out. And that's where I really got the fear complex, because I just felt it was so distressing to experience that. And so I often wonder with the fiber thing, like how often people are eating the fiber and like maybe too much, maybe without enough water, and it creates this concrete, like you were saying. So basically they don't have the healthy relationship with fiber and the amount of fiber that they should be having. And then they just write off fiber. I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, I think 100%. I think you're totally right. And the other thing that happens is that, you know, if you're not used to eating a ton of fiber and you're suddenly like, oh, I'm going to eat a kale salad every day, you're going to get super bloated, right? You're going to get super bloated and gassy and uncomfortable. And you're going to be like, eh, this doesn't feel right. This isn't for me. And the way I usually, you know, counsel people through that is, you know, if you aren't used to eating fiber, you have to start slow. So you have to start with like, you know, 1 to 5 grams, you know, for the first week, and then go up every five grams every week until your body is used to it, because your microbiome does have to adapt to, you know, processing that amount of fiber. The other thing I sometimes, you know, talk about is, for example, like cats and dogs. Don't eat any vegetables, right? So like there are animal species who don't eat any vegetables, and their bodies are totally fine because they are like truly carnivore diet, but their bodies are used to not eating any fiber. So it could be that there are people who really just don't need to eat as much fiber, and there are people who like can solely eat meat and poop. But I think for the majority of us, this isn't true.
So here's a question for you. So this is a phrase that I, again, because I experimented with the carnivore diet as well during this. So I was in those forums a lot and like reading what people were saying. And something people would say a lot was they would talk about like being on carnivore and having significantly less bowel movement, but not feeling constipated. And so people would say like, you're only constipated if you feel constipated. If you don't feel constipated, you're not constipated. So basically like if you don't have bloating, you don't feel constipated, don't worry about the amount of bowel movements is what a lot of the carnivore people say. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. Like, what is the role of, quote, feeling constipated versus the actual amount of bowel movements you have?
I agree with that, actually. I totally agree with that because constipation is kind of like a symptom and not a disease. But, you know, most people, and, you know, I've kind of digested it down to, most people will poop 1 to 3 times a day every 1 to 3 days. And so your normal range might be very different from like somebody, you know, like the three people next to you. And so if you're pooping every 3 days and you don't feel constipated, then you're not constipated. But if you're pooping every 3 days and you're like, ugh, but in between I feel bloated and sluggish, and when I do go, I feel like it has a hard time coming out, then yeah, you're constipated. Obviously, we, you know, as you had kind of pointed out, there's like, you know, the Rome 4 criteria for functional constipation. And it's like, you know, if you have like less than 3 bowel movements a week, or, you know, if like a quarter of the time you feel like you have incomplete evacuation, or they're really hard or difficult to get out, or you feel like you have to do like some manual like disimpaction to get it out. All of those things, you know, if you satisfy those criteria are true. But then for, you know, the rest of us, it's like, you know, we don't know what the textbook says. So if you're feeling okay with the amount that you're pooping, I do think you're fine.
So for example, because this, that kind of answers, but just to like further clarify, Heather said, when should you take action after 1 day of no bowel movement, 2, longer? By action, I mean a laxative, et cetera, not just increasing fluids, et cetera. So when should people take action?
So my answer is 3 days. This is like partially because like of that like 1 to 3 day window, partially because, you know, especially postoperatively, like after surgery, if you haven't pooped in 3 days, by the 3rd and 4th day and 5th day, if you have like a giant bowel movement, it's actually going to be worse. Like, I'd rather you have like a normal sized stool on that 3rd day. I will say that in some people, part of it is getting a baseline. And so really knowing what is your normal, right? So if your normal is that you don't poop, you know, for 5 days and that's normal for you, then maybe wait until the 5th day. But if your normal is actually you poop every day and you haven't pooped in 3 days, I would do a laxative on the 3rd day. 100%.
Speaking of, because you mentioned like being in the hospital, blew my mind. I think you said in the book that, is it 1 out of 6?
ER visits. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because of
constipation or fecal. Yeah. Constipation and fecal impaction. So yeah, which is crazy. Most people do not end up having to get manually disimpacted, which I guess I mentioned just there. And you can do like a really strong 4 liters of Go Lightly and clear them out, or even stronger things like lactulose. But yeah, you know, once in a while we do have to manually disimpact people. I'd say the worst I've ever seen is like maybe like a 9 day stretch at 9 or 10 days, and then we had to manually disimpact. But oftentimes in that situation, there's like some other thing going on, right? So there's definitely some element of like, you know, an underlying medical diagnosis, an underlying pelvic floor disease, in some cases, like even psychiatric conditions where the person is just like not cognizant enough of their bowels to go.
Wow. Yeah, that happened to one of my relatives, actually, having to go to the hospital for that. I remember what happened. I was probably the most empathetic person ever, because I was like, I can't even imagine, like, oh, so you can, well, I'm assuming you can, because it happened to me. I remember I was like doing really well. Like, I was really getting through my psychological, you know, residing trauma from my era of constipation. And I went and had an x-ray done of my colon, and I went on a day that I didn't feel constipated. I was like feeling like I had a bowel movement, and then the x-ray came back and they said I was constipated. That was like the diagnosis. And I was like, this is horrible. I was like, I'm never doing this again. I was like, even when I think I'm not constipated, I am. So I'm curious what you can actually see on an x-ray with this.
You can see poop. Yeah. Yeah. No, you can 100% see poop. So on an x-ray, you can see, basically you can see your colon. And when it's normal or like not full of poop, it's kind of like dark because it's air. Air is dark in this scenario, and fluid is like, you know, white or gray. When it's poop, it actually looks like fluffy clouds through the whole thing. So you can actually see poop through the whole colon. And we had kind of mentioned, like, you know, the diagnostic tools that we usually go with, like, you know, when you have gone past that, like 3 days of constipation or 5 days of constipation or 10 days, and we've tried all the things, you know, all the five things that I named, then we start going down this diagnostic pathway. And I always like to point out that colonoscopy is a great first step, but it is actually not the best tool for diagnosing constipation, right? It's like a fantastic tool for screening for colorectal cancer, and you must do it, in fact, and you have to use it for diagnosing like inflammatory bowel disease and stuff like that. But it really doesn't tell you how your bowel functions, like how it moves. It just kind of tells you if there's anything inside the colon. So the diagnostic steps for evaluating constipation, one is anal manometry. So manometry tests like the sphincter function and the nerve function and how well your anus is actually, like, you know, allowing things to come out. The second thing is MRI defecography, which is a functional MRI. So literally they put you through an MRI and they inject some gel in your butt, in your rectum, and watch as you squeeze it out to see how the muscles are moving and whether there's any like pelvic organ prolapse or what's called a paradoxical contraction, where your muscles can actually close instead of opening. And that is actually a very common reason people have it's called obstructive defecation, where you feel like you can't completely empty. And then the third thing, my favorite study, is actually called a Sitz marker study, where you do just a plain abdominal x-ray, kind of like what you have. You do it on days 1, 3, and 5, and you put a radio opaque marker. You take one, you swallow one with a glass of water on the first day, and there's 24 markers. So on the first day, you should see that there's a pill kind of sitting in your stomach area on the x-ray with all 24 markers on it. On the third day, in a normal person, there will be no stool on the x-ray and all the markers will be gone because they'll have been pooped out. But we check an x-ray on the third day and on the fifth day, because what's abnormal is if you have any markers left and if you have markers in a abnormal distribution in your colon. So if it's kind of like scattered all the way throughout, it could be that like there's kind of like dysmotility throughout your whole colon. It's just not moving properly. If it's in one certain segment, there could be like, you know, some kind of like, you know, blockage or like dysmotility in that area. Or if it's kind of moved throughout all of the colon and is kind of just sitting at the bottom of your pelvis there, like right in your rectum, then we know that your colon's fine, but it can't get out. So it's like kind of like an anus or a pelvic floor problem.
Wow. I did not the same thing. I did a pill cam. Does that also look at the colon, or was that more for the small intestine?
That's the small bowel. Yeah. So the pill cam is for the small bowel, and that kind of, you swallow the pill, right? And then you kind of poop it out and it checks to see if there's anything wrong with the small bowel. Usually for bleeding though, and not usually for constipation. Did they do it for you for constipation?
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. It was because I was struggling with anemia. And so.
Right. Yeah. So forces are bleeding. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. that was the first time, I think the only time, but I got fired by my GI doc because I had already had 3 colonoscopies. And then she was like, we're going to do another colonoscopy. And I was like, I just had one like within the last year. Could we do a pill cam instead? And then I got an email being like, you have been released from.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because I guess she wanted to do a colonoscopy instead. But then I got a new doc and they did the pill cam.
Yeah, no. You know, I am like a, you know, firm believer in colonoscopies for screening. But like for this type of thing, like, you know, it makes people a lot of money and it's not always super necessary to do like, you know, one if the last one was normal.
Yeah. So that was definitely an experience with the medical system that I learned from.
No, that's a good thing to share.
I know. I was talking about it a lot recently because I was doing an episode kind of on that type of thing that happens with
the medical stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was about, you know, just patient empowerment as far as taking agency.
No, I heard that one too. That one was a really, really good one.
Oh, thank you. So I'll tell you what I did get diagnosed with my last colonoscopy, a twisty colon.
Yeah. So a twisty colon or a tortuous colon. In some people, I call it a redundant colon. And that's actually more common in young women. And we don't know why, but we think that it could be due to hormones. It could be due to exactly what I said, right? So which is that if your pelvic floor isn't working, and this could be a combination of like the microbiome and then like long-term holding everything in and trying not to poop. But if you can't let anything out through the door, I always kind of compare it to you're trying to put something, like throw something against a closed door. It's just not coming out. And so as it backs up and backs up, it can actually kind of stretch out your sigmoid colon and it becomes this like tortuous loop. For whatever reason, we see it a lot more in young women, young thin women. The one or two total abdominal colectomies I've had to do generally were in like young thin women who had like tortuous colons.
I've been dying to ask somebody about this. So this is the moment for me. I think I mentioned that I got that diagnosis and a listener reached out to me and said, I heard you say that you had twisted colon. And then she said that she had it and that she got surgery for it and that it was like a game changer. Is it something that requires surgery? And like with me with that diagnosis, what are the practical implications of it? Like, is that going to make me more likely to be constipated in general?
Yes. So because there's more like more of a loop there. And so you're kind of, your stool just kind of sitting in the loop. And you tell me if this is true, but people will commonly tell me that they feel like kind of like there's almost like a lump in their left side, or, you know, when you're super full, you can feel like that bloated area in your lower belly and it doesn't go away until after you poop. And sometimes you can like feel that lump, like I say. So the bottom line is you don't have to have surgery. If you have a tortuous colon or if it's completely twisted, okay, so I should start by, if it's completely twisted and obviously if there's a knot in it, you need to have surgery because that means that nothing is going through. You could have like ischemia, which is lack of blood flow to the colon, and that does become a surgical emergency if it's actually twisted. But a twisty colon generally is like what we call a tortuous colon. So it's kind of like long and loopy. And so instead of being like a straight tube sock, it's kind of like a tube sock that has like a C or P shape or even like an S shape into it, if you can imagine like kind of that. And that means that there's more room for poop to stay before it comes out. So while you can overcome that with, you know, all the things that you described, and which it sounds like you are doing with all the supplementation and Miralax and whatnot. In some cases, when it really, 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 really is bad, you can get surgery for it. And there's three general procedures we do for it. And one is removing that loopy part of the, usually it's a sigmoid colon. So removing that loopy part of the sigmoid colon and reconnecting it. So that is actually pretty straightforward. Like when there's no cancer, no diverticulosis, you know, it's a pretty straightforward procedure. You get connected. Obviously, I always temper this with, you know, any kind of abdominal surgery as a major surgery. And so you can have like harm to adjacent organs and the risk of general anesthesia and bleeding and whatnot and infection. So you still, you really need to be like, hey, I absolutely cannot live with this tortuous colon. And then you would get that redundant loop of sigmoid. And yeah, it straightens out the colon and then you poop great. Like it really, really does work. The other things that you can do though are a rectopexy, which is that you can actually tack that loop of redundant colon and kind of like straighten it out. It's actually a little less invasive because there's no cutting of the bowel. You're kind of just like putting a stitch in it to tack it up. It doesn't work as well because most of the time when you do have loopy colon, you should also take out the loopy colon. And then the third one is a total abdominal colectomy. So if we did all of those diagnostic tests and it looks like your colon is not just loopy in that area, but the entire thing doesn't work, we actually take out the whole thing and then just connect the small bowel to your rectum. So it's kind of like a straight shot there. And, you know, then in most cases, people actually end up having, you know, diarrhea for a while until your body adjusts to it. None of it without risk. There is one fourth scenario, which I did once for like a lovely patient who was like an older woman. And this was like a long time ago. And she had a tortuous colon, same thing, sat in her left side. And it just, you know, she could not poop. She was like miserable. Is you can get a colostomy, which is that, you know, I kind of just divert it, put it, you know, into a colostomy. Like you have a stool bag on the outside. So the poop just comes out. I've had so many people be like, you know, doc, just give me a colostomy, like put me out of my misery. I'm always like, you know, I know it sounds like a great option, but you really have to make sure that like nothing else works before you go through a major abdominal surgery. Cause there's problems with colostomies too. Like they leak, you know, you have to change them all the time. Like it sounds like an answer, but in some cases it is, but in most cases I would say try everything else first.
Wow. Okay. So with the diagnosis, it was on the notes from my colonoscopy, but like, could I go in and get another test to see like what my actual situation is and how bad it is?
I actually would do those three tests. If you were my patient, I would do the manometry and the MRI defecography and the Sitz mark study. And it would actually tell me exactly whether or not, you know, it was like a pelvic like outlet obstruction or if it's your whole colon or just that portion of the colon. Like how many Sitz markers are stuck there. And then you would be like, okay, using that data, and data is always better, you know, we could go be like, okay, you know, we can overcome this or we can do surgery.
And when you say left versus right side, is that from like my perspective or you looking at me?
Yeah, good question. It's your left. So your left side is usually like the sigmoid colon and the most common area where that loopy tortuous colon is.
Okay. I do get the lumpy feeling that you talk about. It's on my right side though.
So the reason that happens is that it's so loopy, it flops onto the right side. It's actually also not uncommon. You can see that on imaging though.
Wow. My experience is basically that if I can keep things flowing and take a lot of digestive enzymes, magnesium, then I'm good. But if it gets backed up, then it's like, then it keeps getting backed up. So I have to like be proactive.
Right. Because then once it's stuck there, it probably just sits there and doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. I honestly, if it was me, I would start with a Sitz mark study and see where all those markers are.
Okay. I'm doing this.
I have a feeling yours are, yeah, it loops over to the right then.
Wow. Okay. This is so fascinating. And then, okay. So this is interesting. So I said that Marissa had a second question that was really interesting. She says, despite chronic constipation, I rarely ever look bloated. My stomach is pretty flat. Has my body just adapted to this?
Yeah. So it's funny because bloating and constipation are not always the same thing. So you can have constipation without being super gassy, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So you can just have a lot of stool backup, but because, you know, the gas producing bacteria, you know, it's not causing you to be super gassy, then you're not going to be bloated.
Okay. Gotcha. And then going back to the different types. So functional constipation, what are the different types and why do you focus on the type that you focus on in the book?
So functional constipation is basically what we kind of said, which is like the Rome 4 criteria. And it's pretty much the most common type, which means that, you know, something's not working functionally. And I do think that, you know, it ends up being like a diagnosis of exclusion because you have to rule out like all the other things, right? So that's primary constipation is functional constipation. And I'll start with secondary constipation first. So secondary constipation means that there's like a medical reason for it or like an anatomical reason for it. And that tends to be things like, you know, like you had, which is like hypothyroidism. In some cases, it can be diabetes. It can be like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It could be like all types of autoimmune diseases, Hashimoto's, chronic kidney disease. So anything that can cause you to be like dehydrated, electrolyte imbalance. And then you can have obviously the anatomical problems, or which is, you know, if you have cancer or like a large bowel obstruction or like a, you know, actual scar tissue or adhesion. So those are things that are causing a blockage, like a physical blockage, versus like the medical things are causing like a physiological constipation. So once you've ruled all those things out, like those are through like a series of blood work and series of CT scans and things like that, then you end up with functional constipation, which then has its own subtypes, right? So chronic idiopathic constipation, you know, is like, we can't figure out any other reason for it, but it's been going on for longer than 6 weeks, you know, pretty constantly you meet all the criteria. You can also have IBS-C, which is irritable bowel syndrome constipation type, as opposed to diarrhea type or mixed type. And that, you know, has like a worldwide prevalence of like 11 to 15% of IBS, but the constipation type is more common in women, like 2 to 1. And the difference between IBS-C and functional constipation is usually the presence of abdominal pain. So having like pain with your constipation, like people will be like constipated without pain. When you have pain, it's usually like a little more IBS-C. And then there's pelvic outlet obstruction, so like obstructed defecation. And then there's slow transit constipation, which is a type of functional constipation, but that ends up being like you have true colonic dysmotility. And that is, you know, diagnosed through a series of tests like we kind of described. And then the other common one is opioid-induced constipation, which, you know, bugs or drugs are going to cause constipation as well. And opioid constipation is like a huge issue in our society right now because of like the opioid crisis and everything. So people who are on opioid pain medications tend to be constipated.
Yeah, speaking to the opioid part, I don't know if I should joke about this, but I often joke about this a little bit because I, you know, people respond differently to different pills. You know, like some people, opioids make them feel great. Other people, you know, not so much. Like for me, pain pills and opioids, like they feel really great. Like just psychologically, like they feel great. But I don't have to ever worry about being addicted because the fear I have of being constipated, like you couldn't pay me to like go long term on opioids. My fear is so bad that like if I have to take like one pill after like a dental surgery or something, is that going to create constipation or is it more chronic use of them?
More chronic use. For most people, one pill is okay. Like a short-term use for like acute indication, like, you know, the 7 days after surgery, you're usually okay in people who are opioid naive. Like if you've been taking them a long time and have like, you know, other things going on, then possibly, but short-term use is totally okay. I think I did want to say like, I don't want to like discount your like psychological trauma because it's like totally real. I think that people definitely have PTSD from psychological, but I'm just always super careful because in women, people tend to be like, constipated, it's all in your head. And so like, while it's psychological, like I 100%, I'm not going to be like, it's all in your head because it isn't, you know?
No, I appreciate that so much. Yeah. And I think for me, it was like multifaceted. Like it was very real when it started and it probably is still real, especially if I have this twisty colon situation going on. But I definitely on top of that had an additional, you know, psychological aspect that developed that didn't help anything either. So yeah. And I do appreciate, because you did mention in the book about how I think you said that, especially with women, they're often told it's either like stress or it's a pelvic floor dysfunction or it's, I don't know, one other thing you mentioned. But I do think that that can be a problem where, you know, maybe it's not looked at completely because it's like a woman coming in complaining about it.
Yeah. And they're like, nope, sorry, you got to deal with it. You know, or I think the other common scenario is you're pregnant and they're like, oh, you got to deal with it. Too bad. You know, but it's definitely not something you have to deal with.
Which I so, so appreciate.
Yeah. No, I'm so sorry you went through that, honestly.
No, thank you. I like, honestly, it's part of the reason I'm doing what I'm doing today, because I got so neurotic about trying to, you know, fix my health that I just started researching all this stuff. So yes, a quick question about the IBS-C. So I was also diagnosed with SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and IBS-C. And I remember, depending on the type of bacteria you had in that, so methane dominant or hydrogen dominant, I remember reading that methane was a neurotransmitter that slows down gut motility. Yeah, how much of that is a factor? Like if people have SIBO and if they're like methane dominant or hydrogen dominant?
Yeah, I think so. The SIBO is a like another good diagnosis that, you know, people tend to fall back on, but like kind of reach towards when we've kind of ruled out all of these other things. And the methane gas producing is true. So it does slow down colon motility. And so if you're like overproducing methane gas, you're going to be a little more constipated. On the other hand, I think what we're going to find, and there's actually some literature right now that, you know, IBS-C and, you know, IBS in general has a lot to do, again, with like certain strains of bacteria. And that kind of ties in with the SIBO, right? So like if you're having more bacteria that are methane producing, then you're going to have a little more constipation. And I think what was truly fascinating now is that they're targeting certain strains of bacteria that are probiotics that are better for certain things. So for example, Bacillus coagulans actually is like super helpful in constipation, like Unique 2, I think is the one strain that's out there. And then for example, like Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium are helpful, but some of the strains will be more helpful for like antibiotic associated diarrhea versus constipation. So you really need to also be looking at like which strains you're actually using. And the really good helpful resources I found is I think it's aeprobiotics.org. And there's one called ibsprobiotics.org that actually like sorts it for you. That's the one I use most often.
Awesome. I remember after it all runs together because it like all of this was happening, but after the SIBO diagnosis, they prescribed me, well, I did a round of rifaximin. Actually, that's when I started feeling like food was sitting in me, I think. But regardless, at one point I did a round of VSL3. And I remember, I mean, if you want evidence that bowel movements are largely about bacteria, that you can have bowel movements, you know, from bacteria, I remember I took that and I was shocked by the amount of stool it made me produce. Like it kind of freaked me out. I think I stopped taking it because I was so freaked out, but it was wild. It was like,
yeah, no, I think that's awesome. That's actually awesome. So, you know, as we know, probiotics help with more the frequency of your stool than the consistency. So they're kind of signaling how often you should poop. Did you ever have pain then? So you did have pain, right? With your constipation?
It's interesting because I remember I was interviewing, I think, a GI doc a few years ago. And I think I realized that maybe I don't actually qualify for IBS like I thought, because I don't really have pain. It's just an anxiety around like bloating and...
Right, right. And, you know, I guess bloating and discomfort can be kind of classified as like, you know, pain, because there is that abdominal hypersensitivity component to IBS.
Yes, which I remember reading one of those studies where I felt, I mean, we're talking about like the psychological aspect, and it was basically looking at the hypersensitivity. So, you know, people being the same actual technical level of quote bloated, but one feels bloated and the other doesn't. And so, which is very real, but then you read that and you're like, okay, so it's kind of is all in my head. You know, like you are just feeling it more than somebody else.
Well, no, because your nerves are telling you that something's happening. So I don't think you're feeling it more. That's kind of interesting. So then my secondary question is, did you have any like downstream effects?
So what type?
Like hemorrhoids and stuff.
Not to my awareness, but actually I didn't feel like I was, but one of my colonoscopies did show, I think, hemorrhoids, which by the way, I was very excited to read that whole part of the book because I realized I knew nothing about hemorrhoids. Like I didn't even know what they were. So what are they?
Well, no, I would say that in that case, you're like super lucky. Actually, you're probably like one of the lucky ones. Hemorrhoids are little bundles of blood vessels that are inside the anus, and we all have them and we're all born with them. But in certain cases, they become symptomatic and they flare up. So most people will think that hemorrhoids are, you know, bleeding and pain and swelling. And when they're painless bleeding, it tends to be internal hemorrhoids. When it's pain and kind of feels like a blueberry lump on the outside or like a little skin tag, or it's called an external hemorrhoid. It's an external hemorrhoid. And then when it's pain and bleeding, it's a fissure. and fissures are little cuts on the anoderm, or like right in the inside lining of the anus. And I actually usually find that people will come in worried about hemorrhoids because they have pain and bleeding, but most commonly they have fissures. So I think you are super lucky that you went through that entire experience without developing hemorrhoids or fissures. So good for you. I think you fixed yourself right.
Hey friends, did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created Avalon X Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST. Well,
on one of them, it did say that I had like some hemorrhoids, but apparently it wasn't.
If it wasn't like big enough for it to cause you problems, like if they're not bleeding or they're not painful, like they can totally be left alone. So some people will feel like they're like itching or swelling a little bit, or like feeling a little pressure, in which case then we start treating them.
I remember the moment that I realized I didn't know what hemorrhoids were. And it was when my friend told me we were talking about hemorrhoids. I think maybe I just told her that I had that on the diagnosis. And she was saying that, well, you know, sometimes you can like pop them out from straining. And I was like, what? I was like, okay, so what? So, which relates to, I think this is one of the first things you say in the book, but you talk about how you interact with patients, which by the way, you're like the dream doctor, just talking to you here. But you talk about how you ask patients about their toilet habits. So would love to talk about this. What is the role of how long we sit on the toilet? How long should we sit on the toilet? And in particular, I was fascinated by like the gender differences and like male versus female, like holding it in or sitting too long on the toilet and like fear and shame of society. So toilet habits, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the poop shaming has a lot to do with some people having constipation for sure. So the general rule of thumb is 2 to 5 minutes on the toilet max. So most mammals poop in 12 seconds because of the way that our colons work. So literally you should be able to sit down, the poop comes out, and you stand up, wipe, and you're done. If you're sitting there for more than 5 minutes, then either the poop isn't ready yet or, well, most of the time the poop isn't ready yet. If you're sitting there for like 20 minutes, like scrolling on your phone, you know, it's actually just been proven in like a Harvard study. It makes your hemorrhoids worse because you're sitting there and all that pressure is actually causing your, you know, perianal tissues to swell. It actually causes your hemorrhoids to prolapse and pop out. So 2 to 5 minutes max, and 20 minutes scrolling on the phone is too long. The poop shaming bit. So there was a New York Times article that said like women will go to extremes to not poop in their office. Like the, there was, it was like, it was funny at the time, but like, it's also kind of sad that people will go to like the office next door or like, you know, have all these products like poopery and blah, 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 things like that, so that people don't know they're pooping. And a lot of it has to do with how we're potty trained. So when we're little, we're like, hey, you know, when you have to go to the potty, you have to sit there until you poop. Right. So that's like the first thing that's wrong. Like, you don't sit there to poop. You actually go and sit when you have to poop, because sitting there for like hours at a time almost feels like punitive. So it's like you cannot get up until you poop. But then on the other hand, it's like once you do poop, people, you know, make comments like, ew, that's stinky. Like, poop is gross, blah, 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 blah. And then so we have this societal effect of being like, hey, you know, we don't want to poop in public. So people actually have like a fear of pooping in public. Right. The one fascinating study was that I think in women and gay men are a lot more fearful of pooping in public and the way that it appears, as opposed to like heterosexual men and like gay women who are like, we don't care. Like, we can make fart jokes in the locker room. I thought that part was fascinating. And I think you can actually see that play out a little bit, because in terms of like who has more butt problems, I definitely see it more in like straight women and gay men.
Wow. Yeah. And I think you also said the study showed, I don't know if it was the same study, but they found that men were more afraid of urinating in public.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Correct.
Which I guess makes sense.
Yeah. Cause then like you have to, you know, stand there and stuff like that. Yeah.
So interestingly, I think for me personally, my mom says that I was the hardest, cause I have two siblings. Apparently I was like super hard to potty train. Like, even though I guess, I don't know if it relates to intelligence or anything, but apparently I was like a late bloomer. Like, it was a lot. I even remember reading books with her about it. So I can remember it, then that's interesting. Do you have thoughts on like the potty training aspect and why it might come easier to some kids than others?
Yeah. And yeah, there are actually like tons of books on this and like people who are more knowledgeable than me. But from what I have read and from my experience potty training my three kids, I don't think it has anything to do with intelligence. And in fact, you know, I think studies have shown that late bloomers are like equally intelligent, and you're just probably like a little more reserved, right? You're like less likely to show your intelligence in public right away. So my oldest daughter, she's about to turn 3, and she actually potty trained in like an instant, because I always thought she was almost like, you know, pretty precocious, and like, you know, she walked early, she talked early, and she potty trained in like 3 days. She actually is now doing this thing where she doesn't want to go to the bathroom anymore. And it's almost like a source of control, right? Because now that she has siblings and she has a new nanny, she's like, no, I won't go to the bathroom. I only want diapers. And so while she can poop and pee on the toilet, she doesn't want to. And it's like a control thing. And I think that's very much her personality. So I was going to say that more so than intelligence, I think your personality has a lot to do with it. You know, we're always like nature versus nurture. Like, you know, how much are you born with and how much is like taught? We have been encouraging pooping since she was little. Like, she is a champion broccoli eater. Like, she knows that, you know, pooping is great. We're always like, hooray, instead of like, yuck. But still, she's like, I won't poop for the nanny. Like, I will only poop in the potty at nighttime with mommy, you know? So that's like a control thing. On the other hand, my second daughter, who is like, you know, turning 18, 19 months now, she is like bold and brazen and like not afraid of anything. And, you know, she is like already sitting on the potty and being like, I'm going to poop and I'm going to wear pull-ups, even if my older sister won't. And anyway, all of which to say is, I think it's more personality than intelligence.
So, so interesting. Oh, and I love, by the way, the section in the book where you do talk about, you know, kids and parenting them with the pooping stuff. And you talk about how you sing them like a let it go song.
Oh my God. You know, even to this day, my daughter will be like, can you sing the poop song? And she's now also obsessed with Frozen. And so we have to be like, let it go, don't hold it in anymore. And it works. I will tell you, the song works.
And Can You Feel the Love Tonight? What's that rendition?
I can see what's happening. And then they grunt. You really have to poop. And then another grunt. You're straining hard. And here's the bottom line. Grunt. It's time for number two. And oh my God, you don't want me singing on your podcast, but that was the song, and that they also request.
That's amazing. Amazing. Okay. Well, here's a big question.
Sorry, Elton John.
This is absolutely amazing. I think you relatively open and close the book with this one poop commandment. So this idea of, I'm might be paraphrasing, but go when you have to go and don't go when you don't have to go. So why does that work? Because I think you say something like, if people actually did this, like it actually is very effective. So how does that practically manifest? Like if we literally just went when we had to go and didn't go when we didn't, when we don't have to go, is that more preventative?
Yes. So I think part of it is like, you know, kind of like you always talk about is obeying your body's signals. And so I think over time we kind of like ignore our body's signals or like, you know, I talk about Ali Wong in her comedy special and she like didn't poop for 9 days because she was so busy and she was just running around and literally forgot to poop, you know? And so it's kind of like if you really paid attention to be your to your body and you poop when you have to poop and you don't poop when you don't. So it prevents constipation developing, but also like, again, the downstream effects, right? So the one reason I say that is that if you don't poop when you have to poop, you're holding things in and that causes some anal muscle spasm, which then can really develop into pelvic floor dysfunction and anal fissures. So that's like holding it in and not pooping when you have to poop. And then on the other hand, when you poop, when you don't have to poop, you're sitting there and straining for 20 minutes on the toilet, then you're kind of developing like hemorrhoids and telling your body, hey, you know, we're trying to go when you don't have to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. And going back to the interesting gender difference, I remember you said that women are more likely to not go when they have to go and men are more likely to go when they don't have to go.
Yeah. And you can see that, like, you know, on TikTok, people are always talking about, like, you know, their boyfriends and husbands being in the bathroom for an hour, you know, like literally just like sitting in the toilet for an hour, or like, you know, moms who are, and not even moms, like everybody who is like, you know, busy, like, you know, professional woman running around like crazy and holding in their poop because of like all the reasons we said above, you're too busy or you're like, you know, poop shaming and like fear of pooping in public.
Speaking of the, I guess I'm just doing being completely TMI on this whole episode. My bathroom habit that I had to start doing that really helped me was I had to stop looking in the toilet afterwards because I realized what I was doing. It's the opposite of the blue.
Yeah, the blue poop challenge. Yeah.
Because I realized I would overanalyze like how long has this taken to go through me. So I just don't look. And that actually has been very freeing. But I remember when the blue poop challenge came out, I was like, I can't do this. I'll like psych myself out like way too much. People in general, do you find that they tend to, well, I guess, have we mentioned constipation stats? So like how many people are constipated typically?
Yeah. So, you know, technically it's 1 in 3 people, one in three Americans, you know, like 100 million Americans out of 300 million. And then the incidence goes up as you age. So like, you know, in some statistics, like 50% by the age of like 50 or 60, more common in women. And then sometimes more common in people of like a lower socioeconomic status. But again, that could be because of like, you know, cultural reasons and diet as well. The looking at poop thing, I 100% think that not looking at it is better. Like, unless you're like truly trying to like diagnose something, I have had people will be like, oh, today it's floaty. Like today it's sinking. Today it's sticky. All of it's related to what you eat. My really good friend, Jesse Wong, actually has a website called poopedia.org where like you can actually look and compare pictures of your poop, you know, if that's something you're inclined to do, to be like, hey, you know, is this an IBS type poop? And, you know, if I stop eating gluten, will it look better? And so there are definitely reasons to do it, but I would say in general, we would try not to do it too long. So you didn't do the blue poop?
No. I was like, this is not the thing for Melanie to do. Oh man.
Yeah. No, I still think it sounds like you did everything right though. You know, like you really worked on it.
My one personal concern is I do feel like I have my system. So I do tend to err on the side of eating lower FODMAP, which you do talk about in the book. I eat the foods that I can digest well, that don't create bloating. And then I have my magnesium and my digestive enzymes. And if I have all of that and like stay on my habits, like I'm good. But I always feel like I'm kind of actively preventing all the time. I don't know. It's not easy.
Yeah. You know, and yeah. And I think that sometimes when I talk to patients and it feels like your entire life is consumed by, you know, taking all your enzymes and your supplements and making sure you don't get bloated. And, you know, I always say like the goal is to get you to a point where you're not thinking about it anymore. And I think it can be done. And I think that, you know, and I usually say like, if you're like, you know, good about your supplements, like 80% of the time, like the other 20% of the time really shouldn't like completely rock the boat, you know, like you fall off the wagon and stuff. Like 80% should be good. And the reason for this is because when people do like IBS elimination diets, you eventually do reintroduce like the, you know, trigger foods and stuff. It's just that you have to identify the trigger foods, like stay away from them the majority of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really happy with the diet that I eat right now. It's like, do I want to bring in more foods or not? But it's an ongoing thing in my head that I think about. I will say, we had a question about this. So, because you're talking about like the 80% of the time, my sort of hack, because if I'm ever really worried about bowel movements and constipation, which is typically when I'm traveling, because then it's, and so actually one of the questions was Joanne, she said, why does it only happen to me when I'm traveling? It's not dehydration or change of diet. I could be camping, staying at a friend's place or a hotel, but it happens every time and it can be 3 to 4 days. So she has that question. Then I'll say what my little hack is, but yeah, traveling.
Yeah. So I actually get that question a lot. And so it is change of diet. It is dehydration, but it is also, sometimes it can be time change. So your circadian rhythm has a lot to do with your bowel movement. So like if you're flying across the, you know, to a different part of the country or across the world, when you're used to pooping at 7 a.m. and suddenly you're pooping at 7 p.m., your like body's like, ah, I can't do it. In some cases, like even just the long plane rides, the long car rides will cause like a little bit of like slow down your gut, essentially, because of the sedentariness.
Okay. And actually that makes a lot of sense, because I worry about it with traveling. And then I worry about it if I have to be up super early for something before my normal circadian rhythm of when my bowel movement would be, I get very stressed about it. But so what I do, because at this point, like I said, like I am actively managing it, but there is that psychological aspect, which I am mostly through, but it still kind of haunts me. I will just do a straight like carnivore night, because, or when I'm traveling, just eat carnivore the whole time, because then I don't have the psychological fear. Cause I'm like, well, at least there's no fiber that can become concrete. There is nothing to actually bloat me. Even if I don't have, even if I have less bowel movements, it's a mindset thing, but it works for me.
No, that's actually fascinating. That's actually really, really cool. I'm going to have to look into that. So the other thing though, and I forgot to throw in the last there, is stress, is actually the stress of traveling. So like you're running around trying to catch an airplane and then you still stimulate that fight or flight response. So people will tell me that they have like hacks like yours, or like, you know, routines that they go to, and they're like, you know, every morning I drink my lemon water, and then, you know, in the afternoon I have a smoothie with like pineapple or whatever. And I think that falling back on these like routines also calms down the nervous system. And so maybe it can help you poop as well.
I was interested to hear your thoughts on this in the book. I also, if I'm traveling, especially, I'll schedule a colonic. It was interesting to hear your thoughts on colonics. What are your thoughts on colonics?
No, this is awesome. So I don't love them. So because like long-term use will, you know, kind of destroy the microbiome and can cause lazy colon. I had one patient once who like thought that he was supposed to get one every month because his mother told him he had to do that. And he's been doing it for like 20 years or whatever. And now he's like, you know, really chronically constipated. The reason is disruption of the microbiome, disruption of the motility. And then in some like severe instances, like, you know, kind of causing damage to the colon lining and perforation. So I don't love them. Like infrequent use is totally okay, but not like a regular thing.
I went through a period of time where I was doing coffee enemas in the morning.
Oh, so you really have tried it all.
Yes. When I tell you.
That's so funny. Yeah, I mean, coffee. And then we talk about coffee. And so like, it's the chlorogenic acid really that stimulates bowel movements, but also like the warm water stimulates bowel movements as well. And then for some people, it really is kind of like a Pavlovian response of like, you smell your coffee in the morning and you immediately go poop and you haven't even drank it yet.
That's actually good to know about the CGA, because I'm going to be launching a coffee line in February.
No way.
Yes. I'll have to get a bag to you, but
I love coffee.
Yay. Okay. Oh my gosh. I can't wait to give it to you. It's going to be called Glow. We basically found, so the CGA content in beans has to do with where they're from and then how they're roasted. So we're sourcing our, we like looked all over to find beans that are really, really high in CGA content naturally. And then we roast them to preserve the CGA content. So it's coffee that helps you glow inside and out because CGA is the master.
Awesome, Melanie. That I haven't seen before. And, you know, I see a lot of products and stuff like that, but that is actually really, really cool. And plus, like, I'm such a huge coffee lover and people are always like, is coffee good or coffee bad? And, you know, there's always like that dehydrating component, but like, you know, I have to have my one cup of coffee a day.
What type of roast do you like?
I usually like a dark roast.
Darker. Okay. So this is like more mid, but it's so delicious. I'll have to get you some. But yeah, no, it was really interesting to read about the coffee and, you know, what's going on there. Like, is it actually the coffee or is it, you know, just the, like you said, the Pavlovian response? Is it the warm water?
It's a little bit of all of them.
All of it. And then, okay, we've covered a lot. I was really, really fascinated that, because you mentioned it earlier, but I'm fascinated that we actually don't have to have our colon. That's mind-blowing to me in theory.
I know. I'm always like kind of sad about it because, like, you know, I'm not like a neurosurgeon or a cardiac surgeon. So in those things, you have to have a brain and you have to have a heart, although you don't have to have the entire thing. But the colon, you can really remove the entire colon. And if you have still some small bowel and rectum, or your small bowel can be connected directly to your anus, you know, and some people who have like proctitis or like, you know, really bad inflammation of the rectum, that gets removed as well. You don't have to have your colon and you can poop. That, I think that's the bottom line. I think what we're finding though is because the gut microbiome is so important, I'm going to guess that there are going to be like long-term effects of not having your entire colon in terms of like mental health and like cardiovascular health and even like your skin, you know, and all these things that are dependent on your microbiome. But anatomically, you do not need it.
When it connects directly to your anus, how does it weight?
So for the most part, we try to preserve your anal sphincter function. So there's the external sphincter and the internal sphincter, which is, you know, the voluntary and involuntary control. So the muscles of the anus are still there. But when you have no colon and no rectum, you take your small bowel, you actually loop the end of it into what's called a J pouch, or there's different configurations, but kind of to simulate like the rectal capacity, and then connect the end of it to the anus. So you can hold things. Because the muscle is still there. You can have like some dysfunction because of the way that the connection is made. So you can have like a little bit of like, you know, laxity. But the idea is that the sphincter function is preserved.
Okay. And then what do you think is the future of all of this? Like you talked in the book about like a cyborg type device.
So sacral neuromodulation is, you know, it's been around for 15, 18 years now, but I think we're still making advances in it. Basically, what you do is you put like a wire lead into your sacrum, into S3, S4 nerves. And most commonly, it's used for fecal incontinence or urinary incontinence. So like if you're peeing or pooping yourself, it actually stimulates the contraction so that you can actually hold things in. But in some people, they're actually also using it for constipation or mixed type things because, you know, the nerve stimulation in general is also helping you identify what muscles need to be moved, which in physical therapy or physical rehab, pelvic floor rehab is called biofeedback. So you're recognizing what muscles need to be moved. I think that is one direction that we could go, is kind of like more sacral neuromodulation. But honestly, like these days, my main direction is that I still think it's going to be all microbiome. Like we've been talking about it for like, you know, 8, 10 years, 12 years. And the more we find about it, the more I'm like, you know, there's going to be certain strains of bacteria that you need or I need, and they're going to be different for each of us.
Do you take probiotics?
I do.
Do you rotate around different ones or?
I actually kind of do. And, you know, some studies will say that, you know, one strain is better, and some studies will say that multi-strain is better. I kind of just rotate in between several that I really like. And Seed is actually one of them, because Seed is developed by Emmeron Meyer, who wrote, you know, The Gut-Brain Connection. It actually has a very, really good blend. The other one that I like is Coloflax, which is like a fiber and probiotic blend. And then the one that I take, you know, most commonly though, is actually just the Costco brand, True Nature, because it's a pretty good blend. And I find that rotating it, and then also having like eating the rainbow and having a really good diet of fruits and vegetables, really does help because you're getting all the prebiotics as well.
Awesome. 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 And listeners, definitely get Constipation Nation. And Carmen does have recipes in the book as well, like including an ultimate poop soup, I think.
I know. And it sounds gross, but honestly, my kids love it. And it's really just chicken meatballs. It's low carb, it's high fiber, high fluid. And I think that's why it works and everybody loves it. So
amazing. One just last rapid fire question. What's your favorite like procedure to perform?
It's actually an Altmaier procedure. So my favorite procedure is an Altmaier, which is removal of a rectal prolapse via perineal incision. So we kind of talked about rectopexies before, where you can kind of stitch up a redundant rectum. But in some people, you can also just pull it all out through the anus and cut off the extra part that way and sew it back up. It's a very satisfying procedure. I love old people, and you tend to have to do it in old people, and they just have such better quality of life afterwards. That would be the one.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Well, was there anything else you wanted to touch on from your book? It is just such a, you know, it's like the Bible of all this information. So people should definitely go get it now. But yeah, anything else you wanted to share with listeners?
No, I think we really hit on so much of it. You know, one of the other things is like people ask me about fecal microbial transplant.
Oh, yeah. FMTs.
Have you tried that?
Well, have I? I've definitely like tried to see if I was eligible, but.
You know, that was actually one of the things I've been thinking about, is that it might be a thing where, you know, we just have pills that we have to take, you know, to boost our microbiome. There's already a couple out on the market now. One is Rebiota. But in the old days, we used to have to do like fecal microbial transplants via colonoscopy and, you know, the blender method. But now there's actually like Open Biome has like a stool bank. Short answer is most people do not need a fecal microbial transplant.
It's something that I really, really wish was, is it still only approved for IBD?
Yep. Inflammatory bowel disease, severe type, and also C. difficile, Clostridium difficile colitis.
Yeah. I remember my grandfather had C. diff when we were looking into doing it for him. I think it's, I don't know. I feel like it has so much potential, and I hope there's more studies, and I hope it expands to more conditions, because
that's what I think.
Yeah. It's like maybe, and especially if it could, like you're talking about like the stool bank and stuff, especially if they could, I don't know if they do this already, but I guess all the stool bank donors, they're healthy. Like they have a healthy situation in there.
They're super screened. Yeah. Yeah, super screened, like I think even more stringent than like blood donating, but they're screened for like hepatitis, like all these infectious diseases. And then you can't have had any kind of like medical conditions, but yeah, they're screened and then the cultures are like separated.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential there. So I'm putting out good vibes that they do more of it.
You and me both.
Awesome. Do you take new patients?
I do take new patients. Yep. Hemorrhoid Centers of America. I take new patients. We have 6 locations in Atlanta, in the greater Atlanta area. So it's Lawrenceville, Decatur, Sandy Springs, Cumming, and Roswell. And I'm missing one.
And you do telehealth as well beyond that?
I do telehealth. But what I was recently super excited about was in October, we launched a digital health platform called Bummed. And bummed.co. And that is where you can get your anal rectal problems treated if you are not near me in Atlanta, basically. So you can actually go online, fill out a short questionnaire, and get matched with one of our providers who will go through the screening process and decide which of our custom compounds works for you. And people get a lot of relief from them. So like, I'm always like, you know, get it for somebody for Christmas, because they will thank you.
Oh, amazing. And you can use the code, or listeners can use the code Backed by Carmen, and that will get you 15% off their first order. So go to bum.co, so BUMMED.co, use code Backed by Carmen for 15% off your first order. And also, if you sign up for the email list there, you will get a constipation prevention guide. And if you want, a guide to avoiding constipation with GLP-1.
Yes, GLP-1 receptor agonist. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty common, constipation?
Super common. Yeah. So super common. Actually, we didn't even talk about that. But yeah, you know, when I first started practicing, is like 1 or 2 people a year would have like GLP-1 receptor agonist like associated constipation. And now it's probably like half the people I see will be on some kind of GLP-1 for weight loss and either having diarrhea or constipation.
I remember, because we talked about it a lot when they first started becoming really popular for weight loss on the intermittent fasting podcast. And I remember reading that one of the mechanisms of actions was how it slowed motility. And I was like, nope. I'm never touching that.
Yeah. Definitely, if you have a history of constipation, I would not recommend it. Even for, like, you know, all the good it can do, like weight loss, like cardiovascular health, like blood glucose management. But it used to be there was like a 7% chance of constipation and like 14% of diarrhea. I think recent studies have actually shown it's more like a 21% of GI issues overall. Which can, again, be managed 100%. And that's what the guide is about, you know, managing by titrating your GLP-1 doses, like increasing slowly, adding magnesium and Miralax to the mix. So it can definitely be managed. It's just if you have a history of it, if you can do anything else, don't do that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this has been absolutely everything I could have wanted and more. Just thank you for what you're doing. And you are working on another book?
I am. It's going to be The Book of Butts, hopefully coming out in a couple of years.
Oh my goodness. Well, we'll have to have you back for that then. Also, would love to meet you in Atlanta sometime.
No, absolutely. We totally need to do that. I didn't even realize we were like neighbors.
I know, like literally, like so close. I'm sure we've, like I said, passed each other many times. But just thank you so much for all that you're doing. I just had the time of my life. I finally got to ask all these questions I've had for like a decade. The very last question I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I am all about the power of mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Yeah, no, I am extremely grateful for my community right now, for the support that I have, you know, in my friends and family and my wife and, you know, my coworkers. Honestly, the power of community cannot be understated. When I was younger, I'm like, oh, I'm a lone wolf. I can do it on my own. But these days, as I grow older, I'm like, you really need to have your tribe around you.
Oh, I love that so much. And your tribe is growing with your infant now.
Yeah, we have like a volleyball team soon. So,
oh my gosh, amazing. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Fong. This was so amazing. Can't wait to hopefully meet you in real life and have you back on the show in the future.
No, thank you so much for having me. If you or your listeners ever have any other questions, you can also always email me.
Amazing. Thank you.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What When Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.